Gorgeous Saturday morning out there. Great day to come and talk about evil. It seems when it's beautiful weather, we should be talking about something good. But I do think ultimately we're talking about something good, and that's talking about how we can fit into that framework. I think I've met all of you before. Does anybody not know me? Okay, so I don't need to introduce myself or nothing. So I'm Tawa. Hello. Everybody say hi, Tawa. Okay, very good. And it really is a joy and a pleasure to be back here this year. Thank you for asking me back, and thank you for coming to talk together. So we're a small enough group that I think we can do this more interactively than otherwise. So if you have questions, thoughts along the way, don't wait till the end. Just shoot a hand up. If I'm in the middle of a thought, I'll finish the thought before I invite you to comment or to ask questions. But otherwise, we'll carry on. Yes, sir. Yes. Well, it's appropriate to ask about the meaning of my name when we're talking about the problem of evil. Did you know that growing up, we learned within about 3 years of elementary school that there is only one animal that rhymes with Tawa? Did you know that? Anybody figure out what animal rhymes with Tawa? It's a specific breed of dog. I heard it. Chihuahua. Right. Yeah, so anyways, it is a unique name. My parents just love native names, and so all four of us kids got native names. My older sisters are Shanoa and Ayana, and my older brother is Mika, and their names respectively mean white doe, dancing lights, and raccoon, and my name means fourth. Fourth, yeah. So they ran out of interesting names before they got to me, but that's okay. All right, so we're going to talk about the question, the problem of evil and suffering in the world today. And we could go through long litanies of examples of evil. We don't have to go far back in time to see examples of evil. We had the Manchester bombing just a couple of months ago. We had the shooting, of course, at a baseball field in Washington, D.C. very recently. We have lots and lots of... Oh, okay, very good. So I'll run it from here. Okay. Lots of examples of evil. You can look at things that people do. Okay, I live just outside Oklahoma City, so, you know, 22 years ago we had the Oklahoma City bombing. The federal building in Oklahoma City was bombed, killing 168 people, including like 23 young children. You've got 9/11, of course, about 16 years ago. You've all sorts of things that people do to other people, right? So all sorts of evil on that front. We also have other kinds of suffering that happen, right? 2004, massive tsunami caused by an earthquake off the coast of Indonesia and wipes out villages, towns, cities, 200,000, 300,000 people. Nobody's quite sure. You couldn't really count the number of dead caused by it. Earthquakes, volcanoes, mudslides, all sorts of natural disasters cause suffering in the world. You have other sorts of evil that... seem harder to kind of pin down what the cause is, right? You've got cancer. We've all known people, family members, friends, who've been stricken by cancer and die early. All sorts of things that we consider evil or that cause suffering in the world. And so the question that's then asked is, if God exists and God is good and God is all-powerful, then why is there such evil in the world? So this is George Carlin, an American comedian, talking about how he tried to wrestle with this question of evil and suffering in the world and embrace the existence of God in the midst of it. And he says, look, I really tried to believe that there's a good God that oversees all this. But I look around and all of the evil that I see suggests that, no, there's nobody in charge. Right? And if there is somebody in charge, it's not a good God. It's some sort of evil being of some sort. A good God wouldn't make a world like this. So there's this emotional presentation by people like George Carlin, lots of others as well, that are like, okay, if God is real, surely God wouldn't make a world like this, would he? He wouldn't create a world in which we suffer, in which there's such evil around us. Okay, and this is, again, this is an emotional presentation. Now, I want to differentiate as we start. Good morning. I want to differentiate really quickly at the start. There are multiple ways of dealing with questions. And God creates us as whole beings, right? The first and greatest commandment is to love the Lord your God with heart, soul, mind, and strength, right? So there are all of these aspects to us, and they're all important, okay? No one is more important or better than the other. But heart, soul, mind, and strength, that means that God creates us with emotions. He creates us with feelings. He creates us with will, with intentions. And he creates us with rationality, with reason, with mind, right? And so there are multiple ways of dealing with things. One of the traditional accusations against Christians is that we tend to rely just on feeling, right? Just on emotion, just on feeling, and not on rationality. Well, one of the ironies, I think, here is that when it comes to the question of evil, it tends to actually be the other way around. You find that there's a lot of Christian philosophers and theologians who give good rational responses to the question of evil and suffering, but then you have people like George Carlin or one of my friends, Bart Ehrman, who present emotional attacks against Christianity based on evil and suffering. Okay, so we do want to talk about that side in a little bit, but as you know, my profession is as an analytical philosopher, and so we're going to focus more on the philosophical, the rational side of responding to the question of evil and suffering. I just want to lay out at the outset, even though that's what my primary focus is going to be, that's not all there is, okay? It's not the most important. It's not the best. It's just that's what I'm better at than the other side. You can ask my kids. I'm not so good at understanding feelings, but I'm really good at giving explanations, okay? This is why it should be this way. Now, suck it up, Buttercup. It doesn't always go over well with kids. But again, I know I need balance, and my wife is kind of the mirror image of me, and so we complement each other very well. But we're going to focus more on the rational side. And when it comes to the rational problem of evil, right, what is the actual rational objection against the existence of God based on evil? This is what it looks like, okay? So this is not me putting the words together. This comes from J.L. Mackey, who is one of the foremost philosophical atheists of the 20th century. And so his argument was, well, it starts with, this is not J.L. Mackey, this is David Hume. And David Hume, 18th century Scottish skeptic, is quoting Epicurus, an ancient Greek philosopher, also an atheist. Right? And so Epicurus says, look, is God willing to prevent evil but not able? Then God's not all-powerful, he's impotent. Right? If he wants to do something but can't, then he doesn't have power. If he has the power to do it but doesn't want to do it, like he wants there to be evil, well, then he's not a good God. He's malevolent. He's evil. But if God were both willing and able to prevent evil, then Epicurus says, and David Hume quotes, why is there evil in the world? There shouldn't be evil in the world. Now, again, this one, there's rationality involved, but there's not an argument. Right? There's not an argument set forth such that if this premise and this premise are true, then this conclusion follows. Right? So I give you two premises. Here are the two premises. All men are mortal. Premise two, Donald Gardner is a man. What's the conclusion of that argument? He is mortal, okay? So he will one day die. Right? That would be an argument, two premises or more leading to a conclusion. Well, this isn't an argument yet. It kind of sounds like it is because it's pointing to a conclusion, but the premises don't actually lead there. You need something more to put it there. And so that's what J.L. Mackey gives us in the 1900s. He gives us the actual logical form of the argument. Okay? Now, notice that, again, this isn't really new. This is just bringing forward the thoughts from Epicurus and Hume. All right? I know this is maybe for a Saturday morning, but we're going to wrestle through this. Okay? So, first of all, he says, okay, God exists. Now, Mackey is an atheist. He doesn't believe God exists. But he says, if God exists, God has the traditional attributes that Christianity gives him, okay? Omnipotence, omnibenevolence, omniscience. He's all-powerful, he's all-knowing, and he's all-good, okay? So, look, an atheist has just as easy a time affirming that if God exists, this is what God would be like, right? A Christian can agree with this, right? If God exists, we believe he does. If God exists, he possesses all power, all knowledge, and all goodness. Fair? So far, so good? Premise one seems true, right? If God exists, he's all-powerful, all-knowing, and all-good. You with me? So premise one is good. Now, Mackey then works out what this means, okay? At least what he thinks it means. So, secondly, an omnipotent being, if God possesses all power, then that suggests that God can do all things, okay? Third, now, we talked about that one last year. I don't know how many of you remember that from last year. It's like pop quiz time, right? But that's a year ago. It's hard to remember things from a year ago. But we did talk about that last year. An omniscient being. So he says, if God is all-knowing, then God knows all things, and he knows how to do all things. So God would then have the knowledge of how to prevent evil, right? So if God is all-powerful, then God has the ability to prevent evil. Why? Because he can do all things. If God is omniscient, then he knows how to prevent evil. Fair? If God is all good, omnibenevolent, then God would have the desire to prevent evil. Okay? So if God has the ability to, the knowledge of how to, and the desire to prevent evil, you put those three things together, and then it would follow that if God exists and he has these three attributes, then there would be no evil. Why? Because God would know how to prevent it, he would desire to prevent it, and he would have the ability to prevent it, and so it would be prevented. Right? So now you have an argument. If God exists, there would be no evil. However, the world that we see has clear examples of evil. Therefore, Mackey concludes, there is no God. So this is for Mackey. This is the primary argument against the existence of God on the basis of evil. Those last three lines in the argument, this is in classical logic. Any of you do formal logic in university? Great class. Great fun. Okay? It's called a modus tollens argument. If P, then Q. Not Q, therefore not P. Okay? So here would be an example. What would be an example of a modus tollens? A simple one to follow. Okay. Shouldn't do this given what you just told me about Johnny Depp, but that's all right. If Donald Trump has been assassinated, then Donald Trump is dead. Donald Trump is not dead. Therefore, he has not been assassinated, right? Because if somebody's been assassinated, clearly they have to be dead. So if P, then Q. If P, Trump has been assassinated, then Q, Trump is dead. Not Q. It is not the case that Trump is dead. Therefore, not P. It is not the case that Trump has been assassinated, okay? So this is just the same style of argument. If God exists, there would be no evil. But there is evil. It is not the case that there is no evil. Therefore, it is not the case that God exists, okay? So it's a very simple, straightforward, logical argument. Well, maybe not simple and straightforward, but it's a valid argument form, okay? So in a valid argument form, it means if the premises are true, the conclusion follows. So now the question is, are the premises true? Well, the first premise is clearly true. If God exists, he is omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent. Premise 5 follows from premises 2 through 4, right? If God has the ability to, the knowledge of how to, and the desire to prevent evil, then it follows that if God exists, there would be no evil. So if those three premises are true, then the rest of the argument would follow as well. So the question is, are those three premises true? Okay, so that's what we're going to walk through together. First, though, I want to back up for a moment and note that it's not just... Sorry, yes. Okay, yep.
As well as with the prompt illustration. Is the point 2, 3, and 4, is the assumption that that concludes all of the possible criteria to be considered? Because with those three, then I guess to a certain degree you come up with your five or your six or whatever.
Your five, yeah.
But if you add in something like freedom of choice being also valued by that same...
Yes.
But can you add in also with this? Or does it say this is all the truth we need, there will be no more added?
Mackey's argument is that this is all there is, okay? The response is going to be that this is not all there is, that there is more than that, and that we need to refine our understanding of at least number 4 and also probably number 2. Okay. Number 3, I think, is solid the way it is. But numbers 2 and number 4 are going to come under some closer scrutiny. So you're just too smart. You're getting ahead of us, which is a good thing, not a bad thing. All right. So the question, if you didn't hear it in the back, is Mackey saying this is all that there is, there's nothing else to be considered? Or could there be some other information that's put into the mix that changes the outcome? And the answer is yes. There's other considerations that need to be made that change the outcome. Okay. So to back up one step, Christianity faces the problem of evil, right? So I don't know how many of you have friends that are not believers. Many times, if you have friends who are not believers, they will say, well, I just can't believe that there's a God that oversees this. You know, you say that God is good, you say that God is all-powerful, but look at the world, right? There's just too much evil. The Holocaust, 9/11, the Crusades, the Inquisition, whatever they want to point to, it's an argument against God in their mind. Any of you ever heard something like that from a friend, a neighbor, a peer, a family member? Okay. So this is, traditionally, this is one of the top three arguments against Christianity, and it's probably the top one, okay, the most frequently cited. Again, I think that's kind of changing as time goes by, and I think that increasingly, and we've talked about this before as well, I think increasingly it's going to be a perceived conflict between Christianity and science, and particularly Darwinian evolution. That's more frequently now cited. I think it's an argument against Christianity, but traditionally, this is it, right? This is the cream of the crop as far as atheist or skeptical arguments go. The argument from evil against the existence of God. But it's important to note that, look, evil exists. All right? And so it's not just Christians that need to account for evil and suffering in the world. Every worldview, every religion, every perspective has to try to give an accounting for why there is evil and suffering in the world. Okay? This is not just unique to Christianity. All perspectives need to give an account for it. And we're going to talk about how some of them do it. We're going to walk briefly through a couple right now, but we're going to look in more detail at how an atheist can try to deal with evil in the second session this morning. Okay? But really quickly, here are five unsatisfactory answers. This comes from Douglas Grotthuss, who's a philosopher at Denver Seminary. And again, we're not going to spend much time on these, but Grotthuss walks through five unsatisfactory responses to the logical problem of evil. He says, well, how about atheism? Okay? Well, on atheism, he argues, and I'm going to make this argument in more detail in the next session, that on atheism, there is no evil. And if there is no evil, there is no problem of evil. Right? But then there is no problem of evil to use as an argument against God. Right? In other words, if atheism is true, there's no reason to call anything evil. There's no satisfactory foundation or grounding for calling something good or evil. We'll come back to that. Second is what we call finite godism, that God is not powerful enough to prevent evil. Okay, so this is the theology of Rabbi Kushner. Why do bad things happen to good people? This also, in some people's minds, is the theology of the Shack. Okay, God wants to stop evil, but he just can't. He's trying, but he's just not able to do so. If this were the case, then I think we have reason to suggest that God is not God. Or that God is certainly not worthy of worship, right? Okay, so finite godism, he says, is unsatisfactory. A God that's not omnibenevolent, right? Again, if God doesn't desire to prevent evil and suffering, then is that really a God that we desire to worship, that we would want to worship? Okay, so again, this seems to be an unsatisfactory explanation. Some worldviews, many forms of Buddhism, just deny the existence of evil. There's not such a thing as evil. Okay, it's an illusion. It's not reality. Again, that one flies in the face of our experience, abundant experience, and even within a Buddhist worldview, it ends up being incoherent. Finally, karma or reincarnation, the argument that evil will get what's coming to it. Karma is an impersonal force. An impersonal force has a hard time attaching to persons, right, and ensuring continuity. Also, it seems unjust that somebody would be punished for something that they do not remember. We don't remember past lives, and so there's some oddness to it. All right, so we're going to set those aside really quickly and move back to the logical problem of evil. So let's then look at how we can re-understand a couple of these premises to understand why evil and God can, in fact, coexist. So, again, the argument, if God exists, he's omnipotent, omniscient, omnibenevolent. If God is omnipotent, he's got the ability to prevent evil. If he's omniscient, he knows how to. If he's omnibenevolent, he has the desire to. Therefore, if God existed, there would be no evil. Okay, so I think that we can come back and we can look at least two of those premises and suggest there's something different about them. Okay, so if you got the handout, you'll see that we're going to look at number four and number two. Okay. So, premise four, an omnibenevolent being has the desire to prevent evil. Now, Pastor Don mentioned that, well, you know, what if this being also has the desire to create free-willed creatures? Okay? This might then have something to do with it. So, one of the traditional responses to the logical problem of evil is called the greater good defense. Right? So an omnibenevolent being has a desire to prevent evil, all other things being equal. Okay? But what if all other things aren't equal? What if God has a greater desire to create creatures with free will? Okay? Well, can God create free will creatures who always do good? Well, what does free will mean? That would be the question, right? If free will is the ability to choose A or to choose B, right, what we call the power of contrary choice, then can God create creatures with that power of contrary choice such that that choice is always used in this direction? Well, the answer to that logically would seem to be no, right? If you create creatures with free choice, they have to be free to choose A or B. Well, if A is good and B is evil, that would suggest they need to be able to choose, legitimately choose, either good or evil, and that those are both legitimate possibilities for them, right? So again, there's two ways of looking at this. The first deals with premise four. Oh dear, that's tiny print, isn't it? Okay, but it's also on your handout, so it's good. It might be on bigger print in your handout. So yes, God is omnibenevolent, right? So God is good. God desires good. God doesn't desire there to be evil in the world. The evil that exists is not according to what God desires for there to be. But is it possible that God has an overriding reason for allowing that evil and suffering? So here would be an example, right? So how many of you have kids that are here with you? Like here in the room. Okay, we've got a couple that have kids that are here and there. Okay, so that's good. So we'll look on you. What's your name? Henry. All right, Henry, and where is your child? Chris. Okay, so Henry and Chris. Very good. So Chris, you're about 22? 24. Okay, I was within the ballpark. Okay, so 24. So think back like 23 years, okay, Henry? Think back to the very first time you held your newborn son. Right? Wonderful time, right? He was really sweet then, very obedient. okay. And now, is Chris your oldest?
Yes,
okay, so very good. So my son is my oldest as well. I have one son, two daughters, okay, so our son is the oldest. So think back to, you first held him and you knew that you loved him, right? You desired his good, right? You desired to protect him from harm, okay? So you've got your newborn Henry in your arms. If I come up with a sword in my hand and like this, what are you going to do? Yeah, you're gonna defend him, right? You're gonna defend him. You're going to attack me to prevent me from inflicting harm upon your son, right? So we could draw this kind of general rule, right? Henry has the desire to stop strangers from stabbing his son with sharp objects. Fair? Okay. Do you see what's coming yet, Chris? No? Okay. We'll get there. Okay. So now you may also remember. I don't know if you were there, okay? But I took my son with my wife. Okay. I took my son to his first inoculations. Okay, to his first vaccination. So we took him to the clinic, and they're going to give him the shots for, you know, whatever it all is. Okay, and so the nurse, you know, she asks me, not my wife, she asks me to hold my son, and she says, hold him very tightly and make sure you hold his arms to his side. I'm like, oh, okay, I can do that, right? I'm not good at a lot of things, but I can do that, right? And the nurse, very nice young lady, she takes a little bell and she tinkles it in front of him and he gives a little giggle and a little smile, right? And then she jabs him in the arm with a needle. Okay? Right? Now, so Chris, you're being held by your father, okay? He's holding your arms to your side. And this pretty lady tinkles a bell in front of you, okay? Your little six-month-old self. And you look up at her and you giggle and grin. And then you experience this sharp object being stabbed into your leg. What's your response? Feel hurt and betrayed. Betrayed by whom?
By everybody,
but by him particularly, right? By your dad. Yeah. You know, I'll never forget this moment in time. Okay, there was this moment in time when this happens. My son gets his first inoculations. And his response, you know, I ask this question in my class all the time. You know, what do you think my son's response would be? And everybody says, oh, well, he screamed. Right? No, that's not his first response. His first response was to look up at me, right? He looked up at me with these eyes that were like, Daddy, how could you have let this happen? I thought you loved me. Right? I saw those words clear as a bell in my son's eyes. Okay? He looked up at me with those eyes, and then he screamed bloody murder. Okay? But before he screamed, before he cried, he looked up at me with this look of utter betrayal on his face. Okay? Now, we said that you have this rule, right, that if I come with a sword trying to stab your son, you're going to protect him, right? But here was this strange lady who came at your son with a sharp object, and not only did you not stop her, you helped her. Why? Why would you break your own rule? You have the desire to prevent your son from being stabbed with sharp objects by strangers, and yet here you are helping a stranger stab your son with a sharp object. What's going on? What's that? There's a greater good, right? There's something that you're pursuing in allowing this that justifies you allowing it to happen. Yes, as a general rule, you desire to prevent your son from being stabbed with sharp objects. But this particular sharp object is accomplishing something that can't be accomplished without the pain that's being inflicted. Okay? If I don't allow this suffering in his life, there is, or at least probably will be, much greater suffering that he will experience as a result. And so allowing this evil, right? Because Chris, you may not remember it consciously, but subconsciously it's there, okay? You may not remember that evil, but it was evil. You would have experienced that as evil, as suffering. Fair? Oh, there you are. So not only does he allow others to do it, he does it himself? Yeah, okay. So you would have experienced it as evil, but why was it permitted? I mean, it's not that your dad doesn't love you, right? It's that your dad does love you and loves you so much that he allows this evil because of the good that this evil is accomplishing, right? Now, can we think of other examples like that? Okay, now vaccinations, I think, are an easy one, right? Chris doesn't understand the purpose of inoculations at 6 months of age. Simple, right? No 6-month-old understands why they have to be stabbed with a sharp object. In the same way that no 6-year-old knows why they have to eat their broccoli, right? They just don't understand, okay? But dad understands. Dad knows there's a greater good being pursued in it. Yes, I know it tastes like dirt, but you need the vitamins that are in it to be able to grow. Yes, I know the needle's going to hurt, but you need the protection that it's going to give against these diseases, okay? There's a greater good being accomplished in it. Are there other examples we can think of where God would permit an evil, or where God has permitted a particular evil because something greater is being accomplished in it? Does the question make sense? Yes. Okay. Is there pain and suffering in heaven? That's a very good question. We know that there will be no more grief in heaven. Right? Revelation 21, 1 through 5. I don't want to misquote it, so we better turn to it, right? It's always dangerous to think you know what it says and not be certain. All right, we're going to skip down right to verse 4. He will wipe every tear from their eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things has passed away. Okay, so that suggests that, yeah, there will be no more, not only mourning or sickness or death, but no more pain. Yes. That is an excellent question that I wrestle with a lot, too. And to be frank, I'm not sure the answer to it. I think the answer is we will still have free will, but I'm not really certain. Right, because here's the way that I process it, right? Okay, so we think we can say that God has a desire to prevent evil, right? But evil seems to be a necessary thing for there to be the type of creatures that God desires to relate to, right? So bottom line, God allows there to be evil. Why? Because the greater good is having free-willed creatures who can choose to worship God, right? That we can worship or not worship, that we can follow or not follow, we can obey or not obey, right? We can be in relationship with our Creator. Many creatures, many humans choose not to, choose to rebel, Okay? Many humans choose to worship, to follow, right? So let's then just segment off that part. So we worship, we follow God, which means we will have eternity with Him in heaven. What will we be like in heaven? Right? Now we know if we're followers of Christ here, does that mean that we always choose right? Well, no, I don't anyways. Maybe some of you are more sanctified, but I don't always do what I know I ought to do, right? Romans 7 can kind of be like a life motto for a lot of us, right? We don't always do the good that we want to do. We find ourselves doing the very thing we don't want to do, right? Now, hopefully, again, that becomes less as we grow more mature in Christ, but all of us continue to struggle with sin, right? But there will be no sin in heaven. So what does that mean about our nature in heaven? Right? What will we be like? Well, we know we'll be different, right? Okay, so we will die, this physical body will pass away, and we will be raised with a new resurrection body with Christ. Okay, well, what will be the nature of that resurrection body? Well, it'll be like His resurrection body. Okay, 1 Corinthians 15, we will be raised like Him. Philippians 3:20 and 21, okay? He will transform our lowly bodies to be like His glorious resurrection body. Well, okay, that's helpful, but it's not. Cause what is His resurrection body like? What will we be like in heaven? And the bottom line is, I don't know, right? I don't have enough information to know what we will be like in heaven. I have some guesses, right? Hopefully they're not just random guesses, right? But I have some expectations, not expectations in terms of I'm demanding this of God, but of what I think it will be like, right? So here's one of the ways I process it, okay? We will have resurrection bodies, which means we will not any longer have, I think, the sinful nature warring with the Spirit within us, okay? So think back to Adam and Eve, right, in the Garden of Eden. Adam and Eve were not born, were not created with a sinful nature, right? But all of their offspring are born with a sinful nature, a bent against God, okay? That innocence, that perfection with which they were created is lost in the Garden of Eden, and we inherit their sin. So we are sinful even from the time my mother conceived me, David says in Psalm 51, right? So we have this bent towards evil. We are going to choose wrong. We have a sinful nature. Okay, our resurrection bodies, we will not have a sinful nature. Right? We won't have this inner war tending towards the wrong. But, and here's the other side. And this is the one that I'm not quite as sure about. But I'm getting more confident about it as I get older. I think we will remember our earthly life, including our earthly sin, when we're in heaven. In other words, we'll remember the wrongs that we have done. I don't think God will, but I think we will. And I don't think we'll remember them in the sense that we hold them against ourselves, but I think we'll remember them in the sense of what they cost. What they cost us, what they cost others, and what they cost Christ. Okay? The hurt that they caused ourselves, the hurt that our sins caused other people, and the hurt that our sins caused to Christ, putting Him on the cross. That is something that Adam and Eve could not understand in the Garden of Eden, right? They did not understand the consequences of sin. Why? Because there were no consequences of sin yet. They couldn't see it, right? We will remember the consequences of our sin. And so I think that we will have freedom, but I think because we will not have a sinful nature, I do think that our freedom in heaven we will use to choose the good. Now, there will be other free-willed creatures that live eternally that continue to use their freedom not for good, but for evil, right? And that is what we call hell. So, in heaven, there will be those who receive resurrection bodies that no longer have sinful nature, and I think we will be able to... Now, please understand again, this is it's not idle speculation, but it is theological speculation, right? Can we be certain on this? No. Does the Word of God say this clearly? No. This is me drawing inferences, implications from what Scripture does say, and I could be entirely wrong. So do not take this in any way, shape, or form as gospel truth. Fair? Okay? But I do think that we will still have freedom, But in freedom, we'll be able to use our freedom for good, but only because we remember the cost of our sin here on earth. Okay, I don't know if that helps at all. No? Okay, I'm sorry. Oh, dear.
No, in a good way. My perspective had always been that I thought that once we would reach heaven, the choice would be between, and this is just for fun and this is for grammar, between good and gooder.
Okay.
The selection choices, I would say, I'm not sure if evil is going to be floating around as an alternative.
Right. I think that's fair to say. And I can see embracing it that way. The struggle I have with looking at it purely that way, I'll ask it first and then I'll back up, okay? Well, then why didn't God just make it that way in the first place? Would be like, that's the skeptic in me saying, well, okay, if that's the way that it's going to be in heaven, there's not kind of the possibility of the choice of evil floating around. Well, why didn't God just do it that way in the first place then and skip all of this mess, right? That was
kind of the robot mentality, the question about freedom, to me at least.
Yeah.
God could have made perfect robots and we would have never, ever had to deal with any of
them. Yes. But the understanding is in heaven, we're still not going to be perfect robots, right? We're still going to have freedom. But if the perspective is, but there's not going to be evil out there that we're able to choose, well, back in the beginning, at least theoretically, we're going to say this and then we're going to back up another step, right? For Adam and Eve, it's not like evil was there floating around in the garden either, right? But then we say, oh, but hang on, but the serpent was there. Okay, so Satan was there in the serpent, and we say, okay, so that was the, impersonation of evil in the garden for them to choose. Well, okay, but then just back up the question another step. Where did Satan come from? Why was Satan evil, right? Well, again, and this is drawing implications from what we do have in Scripture. It seems that Satan was not created evil. Satan was a fallen angel, right? In fact, he was, according to traditional Christian theology, the highest of angels, the most glorious of angels, right? And Satan fell. Satan chose to rebel against God. So how, right? Now, here's the way Augustine is my favorite Christian theologian, philosopher, okay, 4th century, early 5th century, North African. And Augustine talks about the choice between good and gooder and goodest. Okay? So God alone is perfect. Okay? This makes sense. That part's pretty straightforward. God alone is perfect. Okay? So anything that God creates is going to be... Sorry? No. Sorry? Less than perfect. Imperfect. Okay? Now, everything that God creates is going to be good. Right? If God is perfect, He's got a beautiful, holy, pure. Everything God creates is going to be good. But everything God creates, by definition, is going to be not God. And therefore, by definition, is going to be imperfect, not perfect. If God alone is perfect, everything He creates is going to be good, but not goodest. Right? So, go back to the garden then, right? This is totally nothing to do with anything I want to talk about, but this is fun, at least for me. I'm sorry. Everything Adam and Eve have to choose between in the garden is good. Right? It's all good, but not God. Okay, so Augustine kind of processes through this, right? So read his Confessions, beautiful book. And he says, all right, so Adam and Eve have all of this good in front of them, right? And what is their mandate? Their mandate is to focus on God, right? Relationship with God. To walk with God. To heed His voice. To follow His way, right? Because God alone is the greatest good. God alone is the goodest, right? God alone is the perfect. So what is the temptation that Satan brings to them? To be like God, right? And how does he draw their attention in that way? He says, look at the fruit of this tree. All right? So here's the way that I imagine Augustine imagining it, okay? So this is too colloquial, but that's okay, okay? So Adam and Eve are like, ah, God. And Satan's like, hey, look at that tree. And Adam and Eve are like, it's beautiful. What a beautiful tree God made. God. And the Satan's like, no, look at the tree. Look at the fruit on the tree. Oh, the fruit on the tree is beautiful. It looks good because God made it God. And Satan's like, no, look at the fruit of the tree. The fruit of the tree is delicious. It's beautiful. It's good for gaining knowledge. Oh, it's good fruit. But look at God. No, look at the fruit of the tree. Look at the fruit of the tree. Right? So what is Satan trying to get them to do? He's trying to get them to focus on that which is good, but not goodest. Good, but not God. Right? So where does sin come in? By taking the focus away from God and taking the focus on something which is good, right? Now, is it any different today? Okay, is sex good? Yes. Okay, God creates sex, it is good. But when somebody's focus becomes sex rather than God, what happens? It becomes an idol, right? It becomes something that we focus on instead of God, something set up in the place of God, it becomes used for wrong, not good. Is money good? Or possessions good? The things of the world, the created things, are they good? Well, yes. But if they become our focus, right, rather than God, the giver of all good gifts, then it becomes evil. Right? I think Augustine's accounting for the origin of sin is just majestically powerful and persuasive, right? It's not that Adam and Eve are tempted by something bad, because there is nothing bad in the garden. It's all good. Why is it all good? Because God made it. And God doesn't make junk, right? So God makes it good, but their focus is on the good rather than on God. They allow their focus to be drawn to the good rather than to God, right? So if that kind of helps us to understand how Adam and Eve get drawn into sin, incidentally, then again, just back it up a step, and that's how Lucifer falls as well, right? By allowing his focus to be on himself rather than on God. Because God made Lucifer beautiful. And other angels would have looked at Lucifer and said, oh, beautiful, God made you so beautiful. And Lucifer, in listening to that and focusing on himself, would have been drawn away from focus on where his focus should have been, on himself instead, right? So again, so Adam and Eve are drawn into sin, not by something bad, but by having their focus drawn to something which itself was good, but not God, right? Now, fast forward then, what will we be like in heaven? Well, Adam and Eve could not have anticipated the consequences of having their attention drawn by the good, but not the goodest, right? You and I in our resurrection bodies, I think, will be different because we will know, we'll remember the consequences of having our attention drawn by the good and not the goodest, right? And that's so I think in a sense, and this almost gets towards the type of theology that I'm not a huge fan of, but it's almost as if this path of evil is necessary in order to be the eternally redeemed creatures that will choose the good. That if we had not chosen the bad and experienced the consequences of it, we could never actually freely choose only the good and embrace that and follow just God. I don't know. Okay. Now, again, this is somewhat speculative, right? But that's the way that I've and it's only really the last 2 years that I've chased this down a lot. I've been teaching Augustine with our freshman honors class for the last 2 years and just loved being reintroduced to Augustine. I read him as a college student and really hadn't read him for about 15 years and coming back to him and like, this is why I loved Augustine. Augustine was the first really thoughtful Christian author that I ever read, that I ever had to read, right? I was assigned his reading in college, and it was transformative for me then. And I don't know why I stopped reading him for so long, but yeah, okay. Anyways, if that's helpful, good. If it's not, just, yeah, okay. All right, wherever we were is okay. We're going to kind of wrap up a little bit talking about the logical problem of evil. Alvin Plantinga is the Christian philosopher who has written the most on the logical problem of evil in the last kind of 40, 50 years. So he responds directly to J.L. Mackey, right? J.L. Mackey is the one who brings us this argument, okay? And Plantinga responds to it and says, well, no, look, premise four just isn't true, right? Premise four is only true in this sense, right? An omnibenevolent being has the prima facie desire. Prima facie just means before considering all the facts, okay? All other things being equal, yes, God has the desire to prevent evil. But God also has a morally sufficient reason for allowing evil, and thus he has an ultima facie, that is, considering all the facts in the light of everything, an ultima facie desire to allow or not to prevent all evil. Okay, so yes, all other things being equal, God wants to prevent evil, but all other things are not equal, right? The allowance of evil is the only way to accomplish some of the greater good that God desires to accomplish. Okay. Incidentally, one of the things that I think about when I think about greater goods is Good Friday. Okay, so the crucifixion of Christ. This is the only way to accomplish the redemption of humanity. Is Good Friday good? Well, no, it's bad, right? It really ought to be called Black Friday or Bloody Friday, but we call it Good Friday because of what's accomplished through the cross of Christ. Not because of what happens to Christ, not because of what he experiences, but because of what it accomplishes, right? It's accomplishing a greater good. Okay? But then I also want to go back to premise two and plant a hint towards this as well. An omnipotent being has the ability to prevent evil. Again, how many of you remember our discussion of omnipotence last year? I'm not sure if any of you do. No, that's okay. Well, traditionally, a lot of Christians think that omnipotence means God has the ability to do anything, right? To do absolutely anything. I think that's mistaken. I think that's just utterly wrong. Okay? I think God has the ability to do all things that are logically possible, that are consistent with God himself, right? And if God is a rational being, amongst other things, that means God can't do that which is irrational, which means God can't create square triangles. God cannot create a married bachelor, right? Because these things are illogical. They're impossible, right? And impossible things don't become possible just because you add omnipotence to the mix, right? If it's impossible, it's impossible, right? So a triangle is a three-sided geometric shape. That's why you can't make a square triangle. Fair? Right? So God can't make a square triangle either. That doesn't mean God's not omnipotent. That just means a square triangle is not a thing. Right? So how does that relate to this? Well, simply by saying this, that if God desires to create free-willed creatures, free-willed creatures who always do and only do what is right is logically impossible. That's Plantinga's argument, okay? Right? That given the creation of free-willed creatures, evil is an eventually necessary outcome. Those free-willed creatures will use their free will to do what is wrong. Okay? And again, Plantinga inherits kind of Augustine's tradition. He says, look, if the choice is between good and goodest, free will is going to mean sometimes they choose the good, which is not the goodest, and focus on the good is going to become itself evil. And so evil is going to come into the world. If you create free-willed creatures, there's the inevitability of evil. Plantinga calls it the doctrine of trans-world depravity. You don't need to remember that, but it's just kind of interesting. He says, any possible world in which God creates free-willed creatures, there will be evil. If we meet aliens out there somewhere, guess what? Those aliens as well will be sinners. They will do wrong things. Why? Because if they have free will, they will use that free will to do wrong, which means we probably shouldn't be looking for them, actually, because if we find them, they're likely a lot more powerful than us and probably will want to eat us for breakfast, but that's okay. All right, any questions or thoughts on that little bit? Okay, in a nutshell, philosophers today generally conceive, atheists and theistic alike, generally concede that the logical problem of evil is dead, okay? That it's really not an objection to Christianity anymore. That Plantinga, amongst others, have shown that it's logically consistent for God and evil to coexist. That there's nothing about the existence of evil in the world that shows that God can't exist. That it just doesn't work, okay? In other words, Mackey's argument fails. Why? Because premise 4 isn't true, and premise 2 probably isn't true either, okay? Premise 2 is true only in the sense that if God has the ability to prevent evil, but only by not creating free-willed creatures. And if God didn't create free-willed creatures, then we wouldn't be here to be talking about the problem of evil to begin with, right? In other words, the only way for God to create free-willed creatures is for God to create a world in which evil becomes an eventuality. Okay. Thoughts? Questions? All right, you're too slow, so we're going to move on a little bit. That doesn't end the story, so we move on. The logical problem of evil is one version of the problem of evil. There are at least three, okay? There's the logical problem. This is like the strict rational philosopher's problem. Evil cannot coexist with God, period. We're moving on to the evidential problem of evil, which is kind of a combination of a rational and an emotional argument against God, saying, okay, evil can coexist with God, but not the kind or the amount of evil that we see in the world. And then there's what we call the existential or the personal problem of evil, which usually takes more of a format, if God exists and really loves me, he wouldn't have allowed this to happen. Okay? It's more about a specific example of evil and suffering, usually associated with our own life or experience. Okay? So we're going to talk really briefly about the evidential problem of evil, and then we'll shut her down for this session. This comes from William Rowe, who was an atheistic philosopher at Purdue University, just died a couple of years ago. And Rowe said, okay, yes, God and evil can coexist, but, right, so God must have a greater purpose that he's using this evil for, something he's accomplishing through the evil. Therefore, if God exists, there wouldn't be any pointless evil, right? Yes, there would be evil that accomplishes greater purposes, right? So Henry can vaccinate Chris, okay? That's allowed. Why? Because something greater is being accomplished, right? But Henry can't just stab Chris with needles for fun, right? God wouldn't allow that kind of pointless evil because it's not accomplishing anything greater, okay? So if God existed, there would be no pointless evil. But, Rowe argues, there is all kinds of pointless evil. Therefore, he says it's more likely that God does not exist. Now, on what basis does he conclude that there is pointless evil? Well, he just tries to draw scenarios, right? Draws out examples where he says we see this as an example of evil in the world and we don't see what possible purpose it could be accomplishing, therefore there probably isn't a purpose it's accomplishing, therefore it's probably pointless, and if it's probably pointless, then that shows that probably God doesn't exist. There's a lot of probabilities in there, right? So this is a probabilistic argument, it's not a conclusive argument. Nonetheless, Rowe thinks that it has some power, okay? And he builds on what we call a no-see-em inference. You know what no-see-ems are? Those little irritating bugs, right, that you can't really see, but they get in your nose and, yeah, all that. Okay. So he uses what he calls a no-see-em inference, and that means that if we can't see something, probably that something isn't there. Okay. So if we said there is a 10-foot-tall purple elephant sanctuary, and you all looked around, and you didn't, you would probably conclude it doesn't exist. There is no 10-foot-tall pink elephant. Did I say pink or purple? It doesn't matter. There's no elephant at all in the room, right? Because you don't see it. Fair? So, you no see them, you no there, right? However, if somebody said there is a dust mite in the corner of the sanctuary, and we all kind of looked and we're like, I don't see it. Would we be justified in concluding that therefore it's probably not there? No, why not? Because, yeah, we know they're tiny, and we wouldn't be able to see it with our naked eyes anyways, right? So just because I don't see the dust mite in the corner doesn't mean it's not there. But because I don't see the 10-foot-tall pink elephant in the room, that is a good reason for thinking it's not there, right? So, now, what's my point in that? Well, the point is that a no-see-em inference is sometimes valid and sometimes not, right? If it's more like a 10-foot-tall pink elephant and I don't see it, yeah, I should conclude it's not there. But if it's more like a dust mite in the corner and I don't see it, yeah, there's no reason to conclude that it's not there. All right, so how does that relate to Rowe's argument? Well, Rowe is using a no-see-em inference. He's saying, if we look at an example of evil and suffering and we can't see the purpose in it, then we should conclude that there isn't one. And the question is that a valid inference to draw? Is that a valid conclusion to draw or not? Sorry, getting ahead of myself. My argument is that it's not. Why? Because we are not God. And God knows a whole lot more than we do. And if God has a purpose in something, it's quite likely that we aren't going to know what it is. Think back to Joseph, right? Joseph in the book of Genesis, right? He's sold into slavery, thrown in prison, all sorts of horrible things happen to Joseph, right? And if you ask Joseph anywhere along the lines, hey, Joseph, what's the point in your suffering? What's the point in all this stuff that's happening to you? You'd probably just make him start crying, right? It's not until very, very late in the day that Joseph understands what the purpose is. Okay. Now, let's say just for the sake of argument that Joseph never came to understand what the point of his suffering was. Would that mean that there wasn't one? No. And here I think of Job. So we know the point of Job to some degree, right? But does Job ever know why he goes through what he goes through? No. That's the point of the book, is that Job never knows and yet remains faithful to God despite that. He asks God for an answer. Why am I suffering? Why are you doing this to me? And what's God's answer to Job?
Are you God? How dare you?
Right? That he doesn't answer Job. I mean, he answers Job out of the whirlwind, but he doesn't answer Job's questions. He doesn't explain why Job experiences what he experiences. Now, was there a purpose? Was there a point in it? Yes. Does Job know it? No. Right? Isaiah 55, verses 8 and 9. What does Isaiah say? Isaiah 55:8, Bible drill. Sorry, it's not a nice trick to play. For my thoughts are higher than your thoughts, and my ways are higher than your ways, right? As the heavens are high, sorry, your thoughts are not my thoughts, and your ways are not my ways. As the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my thoughts higher than your thoughts, and my ways higher than your ways, right? If God is going about accomplishing some things, it's quite likely that in many specific instances, we won't know what God is accomplishing, at least not right now. Now, many times we'll be able to look back later and see and be able to explain what the purpose is. But oftentimes in that moment, we're not going to know. Okay? So that's one way, I think, that we need to respond to somebody like Roe, who suggests that, look, if God exists, there wouldn't be pointless evil. We can say, well, okay, that might be the case, but there might still be evil that we don't know what the point of it is. It just means that given our confidence in who God is, that we know that the evil is not pointless, right? So Roe wants us to say, if God exists, there wouldn't be pointless evil, but there is pointless evil, therefore God does not exist. Well, what about saying this instead? Okay, if God exists, there would be no pointless evil. God exists, therefore there is no pointless evil. That's a valid argument for him as well, okay? So the same first premise can be used to go in two directions. Right? Roe wants to say, I think that there's pointless evil in the world, therefore I think God doesn't exist. Well, I know God exists. Therefore, I guess the conclusion is, there's no pointless evil. There might be evil that I don't see the point of, but it's not actually pointless evil. Now, I also want to suggest to you that I don't think there's actually any reason to embrace premise one. If God exists, there would be no pointless evil. That might be true, but why should I think it is true? Might it not just be the case that the point of some evil is just the existence of a world with free-willed creatures where sin is allowed to take its course? Right? So why does God allow Henry to stab Chris repeatedly in the arm with needles? Because that's the evil that Henry has in his heart, and God has created a world in which evil is allowed to run its course. Right? So it's not that there's some, you know, it's not that, oh, I said it's going to make Chris stronger. Well, it might have nothing to do with that. It might just have to do with allowing the world to operate according to the principles on which God created it. Okay? That this instance of evil isn't accomplishing some greater good. The greater good is just the type of world that God created in the first place. Okay? That could be. Now, again, I'm not persuaded that that has to be the case. I'm just not persuaded that Roe's first premise is true to begin with, right? And if the first premise is true, the whole argument falls apart. Sorry, if the first premise is not true, the whole argument fails. Yes? Is Satan a creation by human beings? What do you mean by that? I'm not quite sure. Okay. Yeah. That's a good question. Well, certainly if we didn't exist, we wouldn't know anything about Satan. But I think chronologically, I think Satan comes first and then us, Right. So, and again, this is not really explicit in Genesis 1, 2, or 3, but it seems to me that God's immaterial creation occurs before his material creation, which means that the creation of the angels is before the creations of the heavens and the earth. Right. So, and again, this is not gospel truth. This is the best way I can process it. I think God creates the angels. I think Lucifer falls, right, rebels against God before anything in Genesis 1 happens. Right. So I think that predates all of the creation of the earth and human beings and so on. So, yeah, I think Satan exists as a spiritual being opposed to God before the creation of human beings. So Satan doesn't depend on us for his existence. He depends on God for his existence, but not on us. Does that kind of answer the question? Where was it going? There was somewhere else that that's going, I think. Oh. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, how do we, that's a good question. I've really never thought about it in precisely those terms. So maybe the question is, should we conceptualize Satan as just a purely evil being? Right? Is that kind of what the question is? Like, and there again, I think we'd have to go back and we'd have to say, well, no, and why not? Exactly. If he's created by God, then he is created good, right? Now, that doesn't mean that he is good, right? But that means that he can't be just evil, right? Because if there's something created by God, and if God is good, then everything that God creates is going to be good. Think of us, right? So think of, I don't know, Adolf Hitler or whoever you think is the most evil person. Are they just evil? Are they just pure evil? I mean, I know we sometimes talk that way, right? You know, somebody did something really horrific, and we're like, oh, that's just pure evil. But is that what we really mean? Are they just evil? Well, no. If God creates them, right, if they're human beings, they're created in the image of God, then that means there is something good about them, no matter how evil they are, right? Which also, I mean, the good news is that even on your worst day, there is still something good about you, right? Because you're created in the image of God, and so you have value of worth. And so I think I'd have to say the same about Satan, that there's something good about Satan. Now, it doesn't mean that Satan is worth following or that he is good or that, you know, he's going to be redeemed or anything like that. But it means that, no, he can't be just pure evil. So go back to Augustine, right? One of the things Augustine says is that there is no such thing as evil. Says evil is the absence of good, right? Or the privation of good, the lack of good. So insofar as we focus on a good instead of the greatest good, that's what we call evil because there's a lack of goodness in it. It's not the greatest good, and so there's a lack of greatest good. So for something to be pure evil would mean that it possesses no goodness at all, right? So if evil is the lack of good, then something that is pure evil has no good in it. Well, and that literally cannot exist in a world that God has created because everything that God creates is good and therefore there can't be anything that's just pure evil. So that would be another way of coming at it. That's a really good question, though, and I'm just thinking out loud, but that's a fascinating question. How should we conceive of Satan? One other thing that C.S. Lewis said comes to mind. Lewis said we tend to have two equal and opposite errors as human beings when it comes to thinking about Satan. Anybody heard this one before? It's a beautiful line from Lewis. This is on the one hand, you have people who want to say, oh, Satan doesn't exist. You know, it's just kind of a human creation, a human myth. And so we really kind of downplay or neglect or ignore or reject the existence of Satan as a personal agent seeking to deceive and tempt and draw us away from God. Okay, so on the one hand, we have people who try to, you know, ignore Satan altogether. On the other hand, is that we have people who all they want to talk about is Satan, right? And, oh, we got to beware of the devil. We got to beware of what Satan's trying to do. And, you know, Satan this, Satan that. Oh, somebody's sick. They're possessed. Somebody's doing something wrong. Oh, they're possessed. Somebody's smoking. Oh, they've got the demon of cigarettes in them. And so all they want to talk about is Satan, right? So we make Satan into everything or we make Satan into nothing, right? He says we have these two equal and opposite errors. We need to be more balanced. He says recognize that Satan exists and does seek to draw us away, right? It's in one of Peter's letters, right? The devil is like a roaring lion seeking to devour and destroy. But yet, if we're a child of God, does Satan have power over us? And the answer is no, right? So is he the thing that we should be focusing on? No. What's the thing we should be focusing on? Right, God, the greatest good, right? The goodest, okay? So not one of God's creations which is trying to draw us away, but rather focusing on God. So, again, I don't know if that's helpful or not, but yeah.
The basic thinking of this still wrapped up in the difference to me seems to be where your starting point is.
Right.
If your starting point is from God.
Yes.
Or if your starting point is from me.
Yep. Or even from evil, right? So, and again, this is, so if you take that first premise, if God existed, there would be no pointless evil. Where can you go from there? Logically, you can go two different directions, validly, right? If P, then Q. You can go in modus tollens, right? Not Q, therefore not P. That's the way that William Rowe wants to go. You can also go modus ponens, which is P, therefore Q, right? If Donald Trump has been assassinated, then Donald Trump is dead. Well, let's use JFK instead. If JFK has been assassinated, then JFK is dead. JFK has been assassinated, therefore, JFK is dead, right? Those are both solid ways to go. If P, then Q, not Q, therefore not P, or P, therefore Q. Well, Roe wants to go modus tollens, not Q, therefore not P. He thinks that it's more likely that there is pointless evil in the world. That's the me starting point, right? I see evil I can't explain. Okay? I want to start the other direction. I want to go modus ponens. I want to say, well, okay. What am I more confident in? Am I more confident that people exist? Or am I more confident that God exists? And to be frank, I'm much more confident that God exists. Right? All sorts of... And if God exists... And again, if Roe wants to say, if God exists, there would be no pointless evil, well then, I guess there's no pointless evil. Because I'm pretty persuaded that God exists.
Well, and the challenge of doing evangelism to the individual... that is the atheist or the agnostic that pretty much has assumed that they are the standard.
The authority,
of
yeah.
Life,
yeah.
Is that we come at it with a different assumption.
Yes.
Clashing in the middle where we're making certain 1, 2, 3s and they're saying,
yeah.
No.
Right. And sometimes just asking questions can get at the heart of that, right? So asking them why they would think this, right? Or why I should take your word for it, right? So you think 3, 2, 1. Well, why should I think 3? You know, convince me that 3, or convince me that 2. So convince me that there's pointless evil, right? Couldn't this be the outcome of it? And sometimes, well, and again, as we're going to get into in the next session, on what basis are you calling it evil to begin with, right? Well, everybody knows it's wrong. No. That misses the point, right? Okay, everybody might quote unquote know that it's wrong, but why? What makes it wrong? This is, I think, the biggest struggle in a skeptical worldview, is what is it that makes something wrong? It's not enough for you to say, well, I know it's wrong, or you know it's wrong, or we all know it's wrong. Nah, that's insufficient, right? What is it that makes it wrong? All right, I think we should take a quick break. Yeah? Okay, what time do we come back? 11? 5 to 11? Okay, very good. So take about 10 minutes, and we'll start back up.